Hey, Bobby Manning here, Dome Theory. We're on Spotify, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher. Go get us. Gonna talk to Caitlin Cooper, wonderful SB Nation writer who takes the analytical film breakdown game and puts it into entertaining, active, understandable writing that I think is impressive and has made her one of the best writers here on the SB Nation Network, also where I write over at Celtics Blog. Always gain quite a bit of knowledge from her on the Pacers, and we get two games between the Celtics and the Pacers to start this week, starting tonight at 8 o'clock. So thought I'd inform you a little bit about what we're going to see from the Pacers side and look back on that whole Miles Turner and Gordon Hayward debacle that got us going over the offseason. So hope you'll enjoy that conversation. Got into some of the trends and early factors in this NBA season that could start to develop some themes on the defensive end of things, as we've seen teams start to muck up the game more against high-powered offenses and the rise of the three and all these different things that have transpired over the last decade. We're starting a new decade, so we're going to see some new trends inherently start to define a new age of NBA basketball as teams start to respond to the small ball, the pace, the space of the 2010s that the Warriors spearheaded. And does it look like the Warriors era is over? Quite a few thoughts so far. You've heard them on the post-game show. I think the Warriors are going to be closer to the last place in the West than a playoff spot out there, depending on how Draymond Green looks, and I'm not optimistic about that, given his health over the last few years, and those role players are going to make it a challenge out there. Just watch Christian Wood dominate Portland's defense with James Harden. That's going to be a fun combo for as long as we see it. Wish Harden would commit to what could be a pretty fun team out in Houston, but he knows it's not going to be a championship contender. Just saying though, fairly despicable how he's handled this, using COVID, threatening the league, which inherently he obviously doesn't know the impact of being in the club and at these events, regardless of whether it's a strip club, as he seemed to think the syntax was what mattered there. So that brings me to my next point. We got news out of the NCAA. I have certainly railed the NCAA for the way that they have handled, or rather not handled, this COVID pandemic and push for normalcy. Tried to just let conferences and individual schools handle this, which they clearly cannot. And Duke women under Carol Lawson, the former Celtics assistant coach, are the first major program in college basketball to say, we're not doing this anymore. After four games, a shutdown, going back to December 16th, they're going to end this. Carol Lawson had said they should not be playing basketball this year, and they follow up on their word. So it's going to be interesting to see how that impacts the men's program, the most important program in all of college basketball. Duke, who had shut down their non-conference schedule over concerns of COVID. And of course, the college basketball types come out and say they had been struggling, so maybe they're just avoiding the rest of their non-conference slate. Maybe. But what they're doing is the right move. And Coach K, I gave him some crap for his bravado and the Duke program for bragging about their plexiglass windows when they had more money than anybody and other programs did not have that level of money to be able to withstand the pandemic. But as we see, even the big dogs are affected by this. Despite the precautions they take, it is becoming a more rapidly spreading disease into the winter. We're seeing a new strand emerge in Britain as planes fly in from the UK to the US amid that news. Regardless of whether the shutdown that follows effective with that, there's still so much we don't know about this virus. And it is a fairly terrible thing to see student athletes who, you know, are committed to the cause now, willing to take part in this, probably for the most part, if you ask many of them, but with eerie concerns as you see one of the most harrowing sights of the year on a sports field, court, ice, whatever you want to call it, Keontae Johnson collapsing in mid-December, falling into a medically induced coma, over a heart condition that possibly could have been exacerbated by his COVID-19 contraction over the summer. Now you say, that happened off the court. Other things could happen to these guys off the court. Well, we have a body in the NCAA that inherently bears responsibility for what happens in this sport, and they have chosen to go the other way and leave responsibility to the lower levels that clearly can't handle them. Let's take a look at the log this week. Texas A&M shut down December 26th. UCLA-Oregon game postponed December 23rd. South Carolina pausing team activities December 22nd. Multiple Syracuse games postponed after they come into contact with Buffalo's positive cases. UConn-DePaul, a second postponement for the UConn program that had to shut down in the preseason. So you can have a season that's haphazard with different teams playing different amount of games and a guesswork a selection Sunday at the end of it all, with likely some teams dropping out of this season entirely. Other teams with disjointed schedules, and maybe a few lucky ones that get through it all the way without any issues. But that's going to be the minority, it looks like, this season, as this system that the NCAA has outlined, or rather not, is not working. And to me, you have a body here that's trying to absolve itself of responsibility, cost, and burden to some degree, because they're used to offloading the burden of the scheduling and all these different difficulties that come into play when it comes to college basketball. We've talked about, should there be a college basketball commissioner? Those aren't things they want to touch. They don't want centralization. They certainly don't want to get into dialogue with players about what they want to demand out of this season, what kind of safety precautions they want to see. And that's the difference between an NBA, which has agreed and come up with a plan collectively to engage a season despite the risk here. Money and resources are on their side to be able to make this happen. Whereas college basketball, you have big programs, you have small programs. I said this in my video that I did about the sport. It's not a great look to be pushing players who already are deprived of so many rights and benefits of what they're doing to all of a sudden take on the burden of possibly contracting COVID-19, especially when we don't know the lasting impact of this. This season is not going to receive the benefit of a vaccine, and it certainly could as we get into next season. So is there a case to end this season? Postpone this season, perhaps, and come up with a better plan than what we're seeing right now? I'll tell you this. I have no interest in watching any of this. The product has been a disaster. It's hard to follow a team like Syracuse, knowing that at any moment, great progress, like a 6-1 start, could be paused. And if coaches want to complain about that, sure. But these are the bare minimum things that we could be doing within college basketball to make a season happen. And it's just another mark on the image of a sport that was once so great, and through its own arrogance continues to just spiral downward, and that spiral has been exacerbated by this COVID-19 pandemic. All the best to Keontae, his family. He has come out of the coma at this point and is walking toward recovery, but whoever contracts COVID-19 during this season, are they going to be able to come back years later if they have lasting effects of this disease? Mo Bamba in the NBA, as is said today, contracted this in June, still dealing with issues with his health to this day in December, and there's still no timetable for his return. College football players have dealt with similar issues. Can they turn back years later and say, this adversely affected my career, my progression as an athlete? Especially a guy like Keontae Johnson, who was the preseason SEC Player of the Year. I would think no, because of the legal situation that these athletes are in right now. And that's the least of the concerns. And they'll probably get through this without a death. And is that the mark for success? Is college football is likely going to get through this without any deaths? If you have players dealing with the lasting impact of this disease for years to come, I think you're looking at a pretty bad pair of pros and cons for doing this. Do you maybe name a champion at the end of this all? Sure. Are that many people going to care enough to make the possible carnage that's gone through worth it? Never mind another hospital bed being filled up that doesn't necessarily have to, as these hospitals continue to battle with this. Older staff members, coaching members, doesn't even have to be an athlete. Anybody who's associated with this machine grinding forward, as much of the economy is, necessarily impacting the hospital situation, the advancement of the science on all this. It's just not worth it for a body like the NCAA. And I commend the Duke woman for making that first tough stand. Do the Duke men follow at some point here? And does college basketball, losing its most important program, say, what are we doing here? It's worth considering. For the first time, I feel like we're not going to see the end of this college basketball season. And if they listen to Rick Pitino, imagine that, and just postpone this, seeing how the winter went, push back March Madness, got to a better place and a better plan as a sport, perhaps the chance of that happening would have been better. Caitlin Cooper is here. We talked to her now. Check out the video in full if you're watching on my channel here. That interview is over on CLNS Media, a live stream. Be some segments from that as well. And subscribe to the podcast, Dome Theory. Have a couple episodes this week talking about contact tracing at TD Garden, end of the year music with Jamel Smith, and then we're in the 2020. Probably take a little break to start 2020. I catch up on some Celtics coverage and other things into the new year. But appreciate you guys. Got to episode 100 this year. I've done some amazing things with the content. Talked to some great guests, and I have some more lined up in the 2021. So thank you all who have listened, who enjoyed the post-game show, who came here from our Celtics coverage over at CLNS. We try to do things a little differently over here, have some more conversations that expand beyond the Celtics and even beyond sports. So we'll see you throughout the week for some videos here. Caitlin Cooper, Indy Cornrows, SB Nation with us next here on Dome Theory. Welcome, Caitlin Cooper. Been waiting for this one for a while. I've become a big fan of her coverage with the Indiana Pacers here, and we welcome her to Dome Theory. I got quite a few theories here today on the show, but we'll start with the roll and seal, which is what everyone wants to hear about. Brooklyn Celtics, it was a blowout last night. We were watching this game on national TV, 5 o'clock Christmas game, and for 3 years, I've been covering this team, writing about them, and become adjusted to Daniel Tice's go-to play in the pick and roll here, the roll and seal. And Caitlin, I guess it's being outlawed right now. We'll take a quick look at both of these plays with Tristan Thompson starting it off. And I think you can see my screen right now.
Yes, I can see it.
All right, so we'll take a look at this first one. This one I thought was fair to be a foul call. And this is the Tice one. So this one I did not like.
No, that's not an offensive foul.
And we've been seeing this play again and again for 3 years.
That's just opening up. What if Tatum had gone up there? What if Tatum had immediately gone into a floater? He's just opening up and boxing out there. I don't see why that's taking away the defender's movement.
So we're talking to Caitlin Cooper. She knows the game so well. She talks about a lot of strategy, covers the team for Indy Cornrows. And I don't know the rule because I think I've just become so accustomed to this. It looks like a foul. It looks like if we're thinking of freedom of movement in basketball, that shouldn't be allowed, you know, kind of posting up someone as someone else is driving to prevent them from contesting a shot. But as I've said, this has kind of become a fundamental of the Celtics offense in recent years. And it's kind of a little trick, I almost feel like. Like you're posting up, but you're actually blocking someone. So I don't like, what's the letter of the law here?
Yeah, I don't know, but like Sabonis does this as well. Like this isn't even like the roll and then screen into it. Like he's not setting the screen there. He's literally just rolling and then getting in front. Like to me, that could be as easily as a box out as it is them calling it an offensive foul. So Sabonis has not been whistled for this yet. So maybe it is not an all out assault on just this particular play type. Maybe it was just this particular official's preference. Cause I mean, I actually thought of this whenever I was rewatching some of the Pacer game today because Sabonis did that twice against the Knicks and he did not get called for an offensive foul.
And you see Brad Stephen just being like, what's going on? We've been doing this for years. And Tristan Thompson's to start the game here.
looks pretty similar to me. Now, maybe he gets the elbow in there a little bit. Maybe there's a little more, too much arm there. He doesn't do it as smoothly as Tice does.
Yeah, he's carving out a little bit more space than what Tice did in the first clip, but even then.
Yeah, so like this has become Tice's thing, and you mentioned Sabonis too. And a lot of, like, I do this in pickup. You know, there's no refs out there, so I'm just going to, if I'm filling the lane, I'm going to, you know, try to block out a guy who's covering me from helping. So this is going to be interesting as we get into these Indiana and Boston games to start this week, and that's why we're talking to Caitlin Cooper here on the show. Big games start the year for these two in a similar place in the East standing, so we want to get a preview from the Pacers and Celtics perspective here. These teams were interlinked all off season. There was the Gordon Hayward talks. Miles Turner's name was thrown all over the place in terms of trade talks and availability. Turner stays with his team. Hayward suddenly ends up with the Hornets. So that's where we'll start. How surprising was it to you that something didn't get done between the Pacers and the Celtics over the offseason? Like, it just seemed inevitable.
Yeah, I think it was around the time when Mark Stein, I believe it was on Friday, said that the Pacers were Gordon Hayward's preference. And that once Miles Turner's name was out there, I kind of felt like, you know, the worms are out of the can a little bit. Like, this has enough momentum that you kind of need to get it done at this point. But yeah, I mean, once I found out that the package was a first round pick, Miles Turner and Doug McDermott, I was a little bit surprised. But at the same time, I mean, it just doesn't seem like Boston was that concerned with committing that much cap space to a center upgrade, at least. I mean, that's the only thing I can really take away from that as to why the Celtics would not want to take that offer, is that you just didn't want to pay Miles Turner $18 million versus paying the mid-level to Tristan Thompson. At least that's the way I interpreted it from afar.
Yeah, that was my take on it, because I didn't think the Celtics would be able to get Tristan Thompson. And he's been interesting to watch early this year. He's hurt. He's getting back into the flow of things. So I haven't taken too much from his first two games with the team. Good energy, offensive rebounding. I mean, they had 19 against Brooklyn yesterday, and he was a big part of that. So I've always been a massive fan of him. I didn't think they could get him, and when they actually did and were able to use that full mid-level, I was thrilled. I haven't been the biggest Miles Turner fan in the world, but we had this argument for about 4 weeks on the Garden Report that we did here on CLNS, and you have Celtics fans who are furious that they got quote-unquote nothing for him. You technically do get something when you think of a full mid-level exception and a trade exception, but those aren't tangible things for people. And I understand it. You want to get players back, especially if you're a team as thin as the Celtics. So I sympathize a little bit with people who were frustrated that that trade didn't go down. But let's think it would have been Miles Turner, Doug McDermott. From a Pacers perspective, you know, there's probably a reason they were excited to get rid of those guys and acquire Hayward in those situations, which is why I think about maybe Boston didn't want to do it for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was pretty polarizing. There was about probably a 50-50 split on people that wanted that trade or did not want that trade. For me, with what Bjorkren's trying to incorporate with them using so many multiple ball handlers, wanting to play quicker, I think that I was more on the side that I think Gordon Hayward made sense, especially with the different types of defenses that they want to be able to roll through. I think that's easier to do with a smaller lineup versus having two bigs on the floor. And that's where a lot of it comes back to with Miles, is that you're talking about playing Sabonis and Turner and what type of a ceiling that has. Like, I think that Miles would have made the Celtics better. I think he's an overall better player than Tristan Thompson. It just depends on what you're more valuing from a center spot. If you're wanting somebody that's going to help you with your rebounding and maybe be able to switch a little bit out on the perimeter, be more physical, then you probably lean towards Tristan Thompson at a lower annual average value. If you want the rim protector, I think that's pretty definitively Miles, which that showed up big in the Pacers' first game. I mean, he had 8 blocks.
Yep. I heard that.
and there being, are people having to constantly remind you of everything?
Yep, I heard it after opening night. Yeah. I mean, we're going to hear it these first two games. It's kind of going to be a.
Certainly, no one will use these first two games as a referendum on a trade. No one will do that.
There'll be an ultimatum here.
But, yeah, I mean, Miles, in some respects with the Pacers, I wrote a long piece about him headed into the season, because for me, he's just kind of the man of the hour. It's like a decisive season, because for all this time, you know, Frank Vogel and Nate McMillan ran very similar systems, and his like individual leap really hasn't materialized yet. And a lot of people kind of pin that on, well, if he was in a different system or he played more at the five, well, now he and Sabonis are being staggered quite a bit. He's going to be in a different system that emphasizes the 3-point line more. So if it's going to happen, like, for better or worse, moving forward, the Pacers are going to know exactly what he brings to the table, and so is the rest of the league. I mean, a lot of that's going to get revealed this year. So I think a lot of it with him comes down to, can he not just provide theoretical spacing, but be an actualized stretch big that even when he doesn't have the ball, that teams stick to a little bit closer than what the Heat were doing in the playoffs. Miami, for a lot of the time in that first round, was more or less communicating like, hey, we're willing to let you beat us on the back of your center hitting jump shots so that we can really congest driving lanes. They were pinching in a lot off of him. So even sometimes after he'd make a three, they were still doing that. So it wasn't having too much of an impact on what their overall scheme was. And he struggles a bit to make reads as well. I mean, he's not going to be a guy like Sabonis or like what Al Horford was for the Celtics several years ago, where, you know, he's running DHOs or he's making reads that open up the floor with playmaking. That isn't who Miles is. He's got to be somebody that's going to be playing off the action and being able to hit shots that way and making reads of where he can find his spots in the offense, whether off of cuts or whatnot in that regard.
But those are all things I want to talk about. We're probably going to spend half this episode talking about Miles Turner because this audience is so captivated by it. I feel like, so I'm glad I bring you in on this because you've watched a ton of him. You've written about him. I've heard the word frustrating used with him, and there's a lot of fierce advocates of him, and you can see why. He's a shooting center. He can dribble. He can run an offense in certain sets. Elite shot blocker, as we see in that opening night game. The tools are there for this guy to be maybe a top three center if he really met his potential. So I see why people look at a guy who's still in his early 20s, who's on a, you know, medium-sized contract when you think about it, with long-term commitment to a team, no player option, anything like that. There's a lot of appealing things about him. But then when you watch him, and for me, I've watched less Pacers, I've watched more Team USA last summer. Different game, but a bigger role for him there, where he's running the offense quite a bit, poised to shoot a ton with that team and be so involved in the offense. And we all saw how that team panned out, and it was a lot of Celtics in that starting lineup with Turner. So that kind of spoke to me when we get to those trade negotiations. Is this a perfect fit? There seems to be something that's limiting, you know, his physical, his tools, his potential from actually becoming an impactful level player who raises your ceiling. You mentioned the playoff exit, the struggles against Bam Adebayo, Joel Embiid, we've heard about as well. Like, he just doesn't seem to meet the moment against those other great centers.
Yeah, the Team USA one's interesting because, like you said, like a lot of the times in Pacer circles, it's if he could be coached by a different coach that prioritized having him pop to the three-point line rather than just finding an open spot from two. And you kind of thought, you know, maybe Greg Popovich, Steve Kerr's an assistant coach, maybe that materializes. And it didn't necessarily. And like you say, that team faced a lot of zone, a lot of 2-3 and 3-2 zone over there. And he's just not going to make, like, he's not a guy that's going to face up and make a lot of great reads and 4-on-3 situations or with a numbers advantage. But yeah, you mentioned the elite centers with Bam. I felt like his defense against Bam in some of those games held up better than what you would think. The rebounding was still, for the Pacers as a whole, they are just not a great rebounding team. Really struggle corralling long rebounds. But the Joel Embiid front, yeah, I think some of it matters about how are you protecting Miles Turner in these situations, because I think we know at this point that Joel Embiid pretty much owns Miles Turner's soul. Like, you look at their box scores together, how many times, like, you can count it, how many times in the first 5 minutes Miles is going to pick up two fouls, then he's going to go to the bench, then he's going to come back in and pick up his next foul until his offensive rhythm is basically gone. And the Pacers were never very proactive with that. I mean, they had one game against Embiid last year where they mixed in some fronts and were double teaming him, but it was a little bit too little too late. Like, at that point, Miles already has two fouls. I think if you come out with that and sort of like what the Celtics did in their first round series, like bringing those late traps, then Miles is still going to be helpful for you because you're still going to have a rim protector. It's just that a lot of times the Pacers, from a defensive standpoint, which I think is somewhat a reason why they made changes defensively, are very reactionary instead of proactive. So I'm not saying, like, Miles definitely has a weakness defending his own position against more imposing low post threats. That's not even just against Embiid. You're going to see that against Karl-Anthony Towns. I mean, he gets pushed around quite a bit by Andre Drummond in those matchups. Like, bigger players are going to give him problems, but there's more that the Pacers could have done to mask that flaw than what they have. And that will be an interesting thing to watch against Tristan Thompson, because he falls into that category as well.
Like we said, it's gonna make up people's mind about how that should have gone, Tristan versus Turner. It ultimately came down to that, because you couldn't sign Thompson or Serge Ibaka type without a full mid-level exception last year. I get why people wanted Turner in the system, and it's gonna be interesting to see how Indiana handles him going forward. The two big system worked okay last year in the regular season, and then it fell apart into the postseason. Now, as you said, there's a coaching change. And does he just need to get away from playing with another big like Sabonis, who is using that paint area that he could possibly occupy at a better level? I know he's more of a face up, pull up guy at the top of the offense and a post up guy, but it just kind of feels like he does need a new situation. That's what Celtics people were arguing, that if you put him in Brad Stevens' system, made him the only big on the floor, gave him the ability to run the offense with spacing around him at a higher level, maybe it'd free him up a little bit. But I'm interested to see how he looks at the Pacers going forward with that new coach, because it felt like the team did want to get rid of him and, move that salary towards someone like a Hayward, who would fill a wing position and, free themselves of that. And ultimately, it feels like the contract through 2023 have limited their ability to do that, because you look at the player, you would think anyone in the league would want that project, would want to continue to invest and grow in a guy like that. But there he is, still in Indiana.
Yeah, I think for the Pacers, like you said, like if they don't acquire Sabonis and have Sabonis be like this hub of their offense that makes everything hum and that he lubricates things, whether he's screening or running handoffs, like just a lot of stuff that you're not going to get from Miles. I think that they're looking at it and seeing like we get more dimension there. And in the games that Turner hasn't played, surprisingly, like since they've acquired Sabonis, I looked at this number on PBP stats over the offseason, that in the games that Miles did not play, they gave up like 106 points per 100, which granted, that's a limited sample of games. But I think sometimes Sabonis gets this rap of like he's an Enes Kanter and he's not that bad of a defender.
I compared him to a higher level Enes Kanter, and I like Enes Kanter, so that's a compliment from me.
But I think that's where it stems from. I'm not so sure that the Pacers were like, oh, we're just so eager to get rid of him as they were. We think that we would be definitely improved if we had Gordon Hayward, and this is our chance to get somebody who at least once was an all-star and can produce. And like, they don't. The best example I can give is, there was a play even when Gordon Hayward was limited, when the Celtics were playing the Heat, where he denied Jimmy Butler the ball on a cut, fronted Jimmy Butler, closed out the Kelly Olynyk at an angle, chased down a long rebound, pushed the ball up in transition, and threaded a pass to Daniel Tice. Like, the Pacers do not have an interchangeable forward that can do all of those skills at once. Like, TJ Warren is not a passer. Sabonis isn't going to be able to close out like that out to the three-point line. Miles Turner isn't going to be able to do most of those things. So if they could have added somebody like that with the type of, like I said, up-tempo system where they want to be able to move the ball and have lots of different people bring the ball up the floor and initiate offense, then Gordon Hayward made sense. But I don't think that they were just willing to, give up and be, I don't necessarily think they were shopping Miles Turner, I guess is the way that I would put it. I wouldn't be surprised if they still ultimately decide, hey, we have a limited ceiling with these two bigs of what we're going to be able to do in the Eastern Conference, and Miles Turner's our best means of being able to improve. But I don't think that they were just super eager to be like, well, we need to get rid of him.
There was something too that Indiana needed that trade much more than Boston, because Boston ultimately gets flexibility by walking away from that trade. Indiana comes out and it's just like, oh, we still get our two bigs. We get Oladipo, the big question mark, and a bunch of other stuff here that is great, is probably playoff worthy, but does it meet NBA Finals potential? I don't know if a Gordon Hayward Pacers team would have been NBA Finals contender, but it would have made a ton of sense.
Right.
Not only from the him living in Indiana perspective, which is probably where his interest came from, but also his fit there on the wing, a playmaker, kind of a gap between a Sabonis and some of the guards like Malcolm Brogdon there. And he probably would have been the best pacer, if healthy, as we always say with him, since Paul George. I still think he's probably a little bit of a better player than even Victor Oladipo at his height. But it just fell apart. And now all of a sudden in Indiana's sitting here, and it's that same situation that led to a first round exit via sweep last year. I just wonder if there was any way they could have got this done from their perspective. I know Gary Washburn reported Celtics interest in TJ Warren and Victor Oladipo even. I don't know how tightly they were holding on to guys like that, but I feel like the Pacers had quite a bit to offer here that maybe could have gotten this done, and you know, they seriously needed him.
Right. I mean, Kevin Pritchard said in the aftermath that they went as hard as they possibly could. It was my understanding that TJ Warren was off the table, which I think if you're adding TJ Warren and Miles Turner together and getting Hayward back, I'm not sure that you're a better team at that point.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't have the same ability to play small then. I mean, as it is, if you look at the Pacers roster, their entire roster is basically a slew of combo guards and centers. Like, it's a slew of combo guards, centers, TJ Warren and Justin Holiday. Like, they're too small in spots and they're too big in other spots. But it was reported out of the Indy Star that they threw in the first round pick too, which surprised me. That didn't seem to be coming out in the initial, but as you say, like, I do think it was pretty important for the Pacers because Miles Turner is pretty good at playing the good soldier role. He's been asked to sacrifice the last two seasons, but now you're returning a player who definitely knew, hey, you tried to trade.
They asked him about in the opening press conference.
Right. I mean, he would be in Boston if the Celtics, I mean, let's face it, if the Celtics had wanted him, he would be playing for the Celtics right now. At least, yeah. I mean, that's the way I interpret it. So, and as you see, like the first game, I looked at what the touches were, and granted, it's only one game, but that matched what my eye test was from preseason. And he's not suddenly going to move up the food chain. Like, I expect that he'll be more involved and more of his shots will come from the 3-point line, which I think is important for the Pacers' overall functioning. But it's still going to be Sabonis up over 90 touches and Brogdon up over 70. With Miles falling in at about fourth or fifth among the starters, if even some of the bench players get more touches than he does, because he's more of a play finisher. So
it's also hard to read what the exact package would have been, what Boston would have received that respective. So it's tough to second guess it. If it would have been a great package, as Indiana Pritchard say, maybe you do look back on it if you're Boston, especially now looking at what the depth is with the Celtics, and say, you know, even if you're getting Doug McDermott for a year and maybe you can move Miles Turner and trades to happen at some point later, you know, maybe you do that just to try to get more out of this year, because the Celtics are going to be struggling for depth, especially if they get an injury out there. But then all of a sudden, as we say, Tristan Thompson comes along, and I'm much happier about the situation here. Jeff Teague, we'll see. I'm not too crazy about him. He has 19 in the first game, then 0 in the second game. That's the kind of situation they're going to be looking at there. I'm interested to see where the Pacers stand after all this, though. I like their team. I like Gordon Hayward, so I would have liked to have seen the Pacers with Gordon Hayward and, you know, been able to root for them a little bit. Now, I just don't know. I've seen some people say this isn't even a playoff team. I still see some people think that this could be that 4-5 matchup kind of team, which feels like their ceiling, a best-case scenario for them, even given what they have right now. But there's a coaching change, a defensive philosophy change, as you've written about, and a returning star in Victor Oladipo, who has had a tough time, two straight years with injuries. But as we saw when he first arrived in Indiana, he can be a high-level guy who pushes your ceiling just a little bit higher and is one of the most explosive guards in the league. Are those days behind him after some of the gruesome injuries that he's had the last few years and his limited availability? How are you feeling as we get into this?
Yeah, Victor, there's so much murkiness there. I mean, I mentioned this.
That's the whole team right there, isn't it?
It really has. And I feel like I've written, like, their entire roster is the same, but I mentioned this the other day. I feel like I've written about four different teams in like an 18-month period, because you're looking at, you know, the Pacers without Victor, the Pacers reincorporating Victor, the Pacers with Miles Turner and small ball, and now the Pacers back with, you know, hopefully all of their starters intact, though TJ Warren looks pretty limited right now from his plantar fasciitis episode. But with Victor, it felt like in the last game before the hiatus against Boston, the last game in the bubble against Miami, and then the last game in preseason and this one, that he started to show a little bit more flashes. But a lot of the times that's aided by some hot shooting, which I'm not sure how many games you can count on Victor Oladipo to come out and hit like 3 or 4 threes. Like, he's capable of doing that. Is he going to do it every game? Probably not. And it's helpful, like, especially in the game against Boston, Marcus Smart was ducking under several of his screens, which, I mean, somewhat for good reason, because he's not hitting the three very effectively, but Victor's still not getting to the line. And that's kind of where it begins and ends with me. When he starts showing that he can get back into the paint and draw play through some contact, that's going to be the telltale, because he had 22 points in the opener, and he took some shots in the restricted area, but a lot of them were off cuts off of DHO backdoors with Sabonis. And that's great. I'm glad he's finding ways to get more involved in the offense, even when he's off ball, but he wasn't seeing pressure from the Knicks, especially with their bigs and, foul trouble for a lot of the game. So he took three free throws, but that was off of a jump shot foul. Like, none of it was him forcing the action in the paint and actually getting to the line himself, which I think is going to help him weather the ups and downs that he's naturally going to have from the 3-point line that he's had for pretty much his entire career, minus the 17-18 All-Star season. And I thought he looked like he's moving better, and he's pretty crucial, I would say, to how aggressive this team's being in the gaps and with their ball pressure. He's going to be the one providing a lot of the closing speed, where he can really crowd the ball handlers and get back out and spray out better than a lot of what their other options are. And I don't think defensively he's missed that many beats. I thought that pretty shortly after he returned last year. It's mostly coming on the other end, and how his handle is now pretty uncharacteristically loose, especially when he's going from right to left. Sometimes it's rare to see him get into the paint and take an on target layup. A lot of times it's a floater where he's jumping off of his left. He did get into the paint some in the first game, but like I said, he's taking an on target layup without a lot of resistance there at the rim. So that's something to watch against the Celtics, especially since we know they're going to be starting two bigs, as the Pacers are also going to be starting two bigs. So
yeah, that was a surprise there. I was mildly intrigued by a potential Hayward Oladipo swap at some point during all those talks, even in the earliest stages of it, because you think about two guys who, you know, in the recent year haven't worked out in their situations, maybe find a new place, and as they work through their injuries and some of the misfortune that they both met with their teams that they were on last year, just find new footing. And the defense aspect that you mentioned there for Oladipo, especially, like, he would have fit right in alongside Kemba Walker, even though they're two undersized guards, and, you know, put pressure on the ball. So ultimately, Boston strayed away from that because of the availability factor to some degree. The contract expiring within the next year is probably something to do with it as well. Who knows if he can keep them, and is the upside for 1 year even that much? So I ultimately look at that too and back away from it. But this is a guy who, like, not too long ago was really sprouting into one of the premier two guards in all of basketball after that Paul George trade. And it's so interesting to think about him and George now, both in similar situations where you have these stars who are just working to get back from injury. George's case, the shoulder, Oladipo, some lower body stuff. And when we think about these stars, they're pushing their game year in and year out, adding new stuff, layering their game. But, and you could say this about Hayward too, when you are just trying to get back from injuries, that becomes the only focus. So instead of, you know, adding to your dribbling or adding to your shooting or any of this other stuff, you're just trying to get back physically. And that plagues these guys for years after they're just able to get their footing back. So, you know, Hayward that first year out didn't have anything new to his game in 19. And then he comes back with the full season off season after that and adds some stuff to his game. How much do you have a sense that Oladipo was able to actually work on his game this offseason rather than rehab and work his way back? Because that's always what I look at with a star who's recovering from injury, as he has been.
Right. So I would say definitely during the hiatus, and based on what he said in retrospect now about the bubble, is that he wasn't 100% when he returned for those first 13 games, and he wasn't 100% when he was in the bubble. So I'm under the impression that a lot of that, even the games themselves, he was viewing as rehab. Yeah. Now, since then until now, he made a remark after, I want to say, the second preseason game, where he feels like he's more explosive now and has more speed, but he's not used to having that much speed anymore. So he's kind of having to reacquaint his body to that. I haven't noticed a lot of that myself, but that's what indication he has.
That's a preseason comment there.
Yeah, that he feels, he said he feels better in his body. I mean, I think you can notice a little bit of an extra burst that he had a few times, especially in the first game against the Knicks, where in transition he was able to kind of put on the Jets a little bit more than what you would have seen. But overall, I'm not sure how much added skill he's really been able to work on aside from like shooting, because when you listen to him talk, it just sounds like I said, that a lot of the, most of the bubble was just him using that as a means to rehab his body. And I think you could tell that when he was down there, because there were just some possessions where it didn't seem like he was going full out.
Yeah.
Like, not that I'm saying he was being lazy, but just like kind of casual, and that he was trying to get through it more than, you know, be back.
Yeah, that's something you have to consider about their finish too to last year. I don't read into it too much because of that Oladipo uncertainty that they were dealing with then. Is he back? Is he not? That seemed to be the whole story of the team in the bubble, was whether or not he was going to be fully not only integrated into the team in a recovery sense, but committed to the team with all the trade rumors that were surrounding him at that time. And those aren't going to go away given the contract situation that he's dealing with right now. So Indiana, I want to love that team. I like the pair of bigs there. I've always liked Malcolm Brogdon. I'm a big fan of him back to his Milwaukee days. I like the system. I like their consistency. They've done a lot with a little over the years, but there just seems to be a lot of uncertainty around this team. Oladipo, the wings, is TJ Warren, you know, with there's already uncertainty around him, as you've mentioned. What are you looking for in the early part of this season to get a sense of who this team is, especially with Bjorkman starting now?
Well, I think that the first thing in the preseason, that at least like, and I don't know if all this is going to add up to a different finish, but at least it's not necessarily more of the same. And I think that you have a better shot. Like, there's going to be more variance for the Pacers on both ends of the floor. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing, because game in and game out, you know, Nate McMillan is a floor raiser. They're going to come out and they're going to play hard and they're going to compete, but they're also going to take a ton of mid-range twos. They're not going to get a lot of points from the three-point line. They're not going to get to the free throw line. And if you're not hitting those mid-range twos in the playoffs, then, which they weren't in the 17-18 season against the Cavs, then you have somewhat of a limited ceiling. So in the first three preseason games, they took over 43s. In the first game against the Knicks, I think they took 36, which is, I mean, they were dead last in three-point attempts last year. They were dead last in free throw attempt rate last year, which I'm not sure the free throws are going to inch much above that, because some of those guys, like, that's just not TJ Warren's game.
Yeah.
Like, he's a guy who's going to kind of lean away from contact and take a lot of floaters. That's just who he is.
Is he a guy who can continue that bubble stretch? I know you mentioned the injuries that he's dealing with right now, but that was the other story of them in the bubble. His explosiveness, probably one of the, I think he was all bubble team. That was a thing.
Yeah.
He made the all bubble team. So like all of a sudden this guy who was with Phoenix and, you know, was a good player there, good contract, they pick him up for nothing essentially in that trade, and now he looks like a legit piece for Indiana.
Sure. I mean, I think one thing that's going to be hard for the Pacers to balance is that exactly right there. I mean, in the aftermath of that Hayward deal falling through, like, all in the same breath, Kevin Pritchard says, like, well, we went as hard as we possibly could after a player. We think Turner and Sabonis are complementary, and we think that TJ Warren excels at the four. Like, I don't see how all three of those things can really be true.
Yeah.
Especially when they also want to get development minutes for Goga. So I don't know how you balance all of that. I mean, TJ, a lot of what his explosion in the bubble was about was that he was expanding his game to the 3-point line. I mean, last year, even in the minutes, he did play some minutes at the four, and you'd see like if a big's way dropped into the paint, he would dribble into a two. He wasn't going to stop and pop and pull up for like a one dribble three. And that's what he was doing in the bubble. But he also had a lot more room to diversify some of his scoring profile. I mean, he's playing at the four, so there's opportunities to run 4-5 pick and roll. You're not doing that with Turner and Sabonis. There's opportunities for Turner to bust it up the floor. I mean, for TJ to bust it up the floor and outrun a four to hit a transition three. You're not doing that with Turner and Sabonis. Like, he also dabbled some in the mid post. They took him off of Iverson cuts. I mean, just a lot of different things that they weren't necessarily doing during the regular season. Him having a shift in position where he could be quicker than bigger fours, I think, made a difference for him. So I think so far, like in the first game, they played the two bigs about 18 minutes together, which wasn't too far off from what they averaged last year. But I think there'll be an emphasis to get TJ more minutes at power forward than there was a year ago, and kind of provide them a glimpse of what they could be. Because I mean, I think it would have been like, especially in the playoffs, Sabonis is going to provide more support, I think, to that look than what Miles did, because for one, a lot of the, you know, kind of micro things like his screening, his passing, but also, you know, Miami switching, and they didn't have somebody to really punish those switches or to spread the floor with playmaking and just the rebounding. I mean, they gave up a lot of second chance opportunities where you're not going to be sacrificing that as much with Sabonis. So they haven't gotten a really good look at that yet. Do I think that TJ is going to shoot like 60% from three and 55% from the field like he did in the seeding games? No, but I think he has a lot to gain in this system. And I think of all the players on the Pacers roster, he probably has the most to gain to build off of. And that's why it's really a shame that he started out with continued plantar fasciitis issues that he had in the bubble, and that's still bothering him. Cause you could see in the first game that there's times where it looks like he was running on pins and needles, that he tried to double the post and couldn't spray back out and just was not moving very well. So that'll be something to watch over the weekend with the Pacers having a back-to-back.
We're talking to Caitlin Cooper, Indy Cornrows, SB Nation. Hope you're enjoying this Pacers talk as much as I am here. There's a team I'm just trying to figure out. Like, who are they? Where are they going to stand? So I had to do this episode. But Caitlin's someone I've been following for a little while here, has become one of the rising stars in NBA writing circles. Literal breakdowns, video work, great adjectives, excellent flow, to the point. It's all great stuff from her, and really hones in on individual players, their games, the X's and O's. You just learn a ton by reading from her. So I want to get a little bit in the hair journey here before we wrap this with a short preview of the two games that the Celtics and Pacers are going to play this week. What inspired you to pursue this line of work and the angle at which you come at basketball writing from?
So I guess I would say I'm pretty extremely Indiana in the sense that I grew up, my dad coached high school basketball in Indiana for about over a decade. So when I was little, I was a lot like Hayden Panettiere's character in Remember the Titans. Like, if there was practice going on, I was there. If there was scouting trips going on, I was hopping in the car and going to those games. So I absorbed a lot of basketball that way. If there was multiple coaches having conversations, I always wanted to be in on them. I was always flipping through playbooks. So a lot of it just kind of came from osmosis that way. The more you're around coach speak, I think some of it, just grows that way. And since then, like I, especially during the hiatus, if there's videos on YouTube about any team, I was watching a long, like 30 minute breakdown of a Jewish D1 school in New York for about a long time. Just anything I can learn about basketball, that's what I do. And I try to reflect that in what I do at Indy Cornrows. I mean, I don't have the access or the sources that a lot of writers are going to have. So it's kind of a sense of, you know, how are you going to differentiate yourself? Like, I'm not going to say that I do something better than somebody else, but I need to have a unique angle that why is somebody going to click a link that I write? And hopefully, you know, I like to really zero in on the tiny things or the minutiae and help people to, you know, they're going to recognize that in a game and remember, hey, I read that in Caitlin's article.
That you talk about coach speak, and you know, some of the best film people I've talked to, scouting people, and just people who are around breaking down the game and angles and all that different stuff. Coach speak's different. Every level, every team even can have different terminology for the same things. Sure. And I think that's one of the most interesting thing for the people who come at the game the way you do, is translating that coach's speak to what people can understand in a very literal sense. There's a lot of names for similar stuff. I can't even think of any examples myself. You probably have a better example you could throw out there in that sense. But how do you go about translating that coach's speak to, you know, stuff readers can consume fairly easily?
Right. So like ice coverage could be push coverage, could be blue coverage.
There,
like,
we
that
go.
Type,
there
that,
we go.
That type of thing. One very simple thing that I do, which somebody laughed at me about this the one day, but my sister is not into sports like at all. So when I get done writing articles, a lot of times I'll be like, hey, I want you to read this. And if when I get to the end of it, I always ask her two questions. One, were you completely bored? Like, were you entertained reading this at all? Were there any, like you said, I'm it means a lot that you said you liked my adjective usage, because that's something that I work on a lot. So like, is this a completely dry thing that you just don't want to read again? And then also, did you understand what I was saying? Because if she's somebody that really doesn't watch a lot of basketball and she feels like, hey, you know, buy the video clips, buy, you know, the annotated pictures that you use, I have a pretty good sense of what you're getting at. Then I feel like I'm on the right track. But if she comes back and tells me, like, I have no idea what this was, then I go back to the drawing board a little bit. But I use her as my litmus test. But some of it, I think what you said is true. Like, I did a long freelance piece for on Sabonis's screening technique at the flagship before SB Nation kind of broke off into being more the team sites again. But I like to use more like illusions. Like, I kind of talked about Sabonis being like, when he rescreens with Jeremy Lamb off a dribble handoff, like being a grapevine going through, you know, a lattice, so that people have a visual interpretation of what it is, that even if they don't know exactly what the terminology is, they can kind of picture it. So that's something I work on a lot. And then also just having multiple things, that you're explaining what's in the video. You might have a picture where I draw it out, and hope that it all comes through that way. Or at least I hope that, I mean, most readers tell me that they have a pretty good indication of what I'm talking about. I hope so.
For sure. My last question on all this is, what I think is so great about basketball coverage and what allows so many people into it, and there's just such this monster of coverage around the NBA and just basketball in general, is there's so many ways to go at it. You can do the video breakdowns. You can be more into the you know, TMZ celebrity side of things. You know, it's such a celebrity game now. And then you have trade transaction stuff that people love. Some people are cap people. Like, there's just so many different ways to go at this. And you have a week like this with the whole James Harden situation. And like, I'm going sick of it, but I can see why people are so into it. Like, he's such a captivating player, one of the greatest players of all time, and he's available. But there's also all this other stuff going on off the basketball court that people are wondering, you know, how is this impacting his value? And, you know, there's a lot of tracking of where he's going, where he's been, the whole COVID situation. Like, there's just so many different parts of basketball coverage that are coming together around him. I've gotten a little sick of it. Does the whole story intrigue you at all? Just everything going on around him in a coverage sense, like, you know, how do you cover a guy like this right now with just everything that's going on around him?
Right. I think in a general sense, like, I don't want to be the person that tells a fan how to be a fan, like, whatever they like. I'm not going to be everybody's cup of tea, and I understand that. But I do wish as a whole that the NBA would focus, like, that the coverage would be a little bit more in the moment. I feel like so much of the time we're looking at what's coming next. Like, where is James Harden going to get traded, and what's that going to mean for this team? Or where is X free agent who isn't a free agent for a whole nother year? What team are they going to choose, instead of, like, you know, on Christmas Day, instead of taking time in between games to talk about the James Harden saga, like, maybe break down a little bit more of what's happening for the two teams that are playing, or do a little bit more of a preview about that. I forget which game it might have been, the very first game yesterday, where they were talking about James Harden, instead of, like, providing a more in-depth, which, granted, there's not a lot to work off of right now because there's only been one game. But I think so much of the time, a lot of the pre-game coverage and the studio coverage focuses on, you know, the main, well, we only care about which teams are getting to the finals. So we're going to talk about the Lakers, or we're going to talk about the Clippers, or we're going to talk about the Bucks, without really selling us on what some of the small market teams who are going to be in the playoffs later, whether they're, you know, real or it turn out to be, you know, pretender contenders, to sell the entire product. I mean, on the James Harden saga, I think it's kind of tough because right now it just feels like he doesn't have a very good read of the room, and it all comes off a little tone deaf given the current world that we live in with the COVID situation, to be at all of these parties without masks on and bringing that risk to his teammates, whether he was ultimately the cause of why that spread in Houston or not. Like, it just doesn't come across well when we're dealing with something that's killed over 300,000 Americans. But my overall take is that I just wish that the entire coverage was more of the moment, and that we talked more about was what's happening in the actual games.
It goes back to the off season being bigger than the season. I mean, we do shows during the off season that will draw 14,000-15,000 people. That whole Pacers Celtics saga there is probably going to be a bigger deal than any Celtics game this year, as we look ahead. So that's a great point. And, like, you know, I guess as much into the transaction and the trade machine and all that stuff as other people, but I love the game, and you love the game too. I'm almost certain, like, where it's gone, the amount of great players there are, the amount of teams that are intriguing. Like, I think you can look at pretty much 28 of the 30 teams having something interesting about them. I guess I'd, you know, leave out the, you know, even the Hornets have something interesting now when Hayward arriving there. Like, almost every year when you come into it, there's 30 storylines, 30 teams with something to watch for, to more or less of a degree there. And, you know, I can watch a Detroit-Atlanta game and look for the rookies, look for Blake Griffin on Detroit. Like, especially at the beginning of the season, there's so much to watch for. And you're right, like, the game, the day-to-day, the, you know, between the lines and the, you know, plays that are going on, like, those are intriguing to me. But the ratings are down for the league in terms of games. And, you know, like, we just see how people react to the game. They're more interested in the stuff off the court than on the court. And what does that say about the game? Like, you know, does it say something about the amount of threes that are being taken, the way the game is transformed? Or is it just social media and people getting so caught up in the rumors and, you know, what's being said on Twitter more than what's going on the TV?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it, too. I mean, I saw somebody had grouped together all of the tweets that ESPN and Bleacher Report had shared after the Bucks win yesterday, and none of them were about the Bucks. They were all about Steph Curry makes a three, or the Warriors do this, or Steph Curry's reaction to Kelly Oubre taking a 1-on-4 shot. Like, it wasn't really talking about, you know, Chris Middleton's big day. Like, it wasn't telling you anything about the Bucks. So I think some of it, we all like to kind of project what the ratings issue is on our personal pet peeve, but I certainly don't think it's helping to only be covering certain teams, which I get that, you know, they know from an SEO perspective and from what their site traffic are, that the Lakers are going to be a big driver of traffic. But at the end of the day, if there's a million posts on Alex Caruso doing X, Y, or Z, and you're not covering half the teams, then when those teams get into the playoffs or those teams are on national TV, a lot of people don't know anything about that team. Like, I mean, right now there's a lot that's changed about the Pacers, and they don't have a lot of national TV games, but when they finally do have one, like, you would hope that before the game starts, you would be talking about, hey, you know, the Pacers shot profile has changed. Their defense is a lot less conservative, a lot of ball pressure. They want to take huge sections of the shot clock off by how they're going to run their coverage, you know, this, that, or the other. And I just don't think that we learn that much about stylistically, you know, how do the Phoenix Suns want to play this year? How do the Pelicans want to play with Stan Van Gundy as their coach? Like I said, before that Heat Pelicans game tipped, there was basically no conversation with those two teams. So,
well, hopefully this new playoff format will help that to some degree, because I think one of the issues is that teams sort of die out throughout the year, especially at the lower levels, and those storylines start to disappear, and you just consolidate things more and more until finally, you know, there's four teams that matter at the end of the year in each conference finals. I think, you know, what we saw in the bubble is that you could get a Portland Trailblazers team that wasn't a realistic NBA Finals contender, but could build an incredible story around that late regular season, early playoff position right there, and draw a lot of interest and intrigue in a team that, you know, doesn't have the upside of a Lakers, of a Miami Heat last year. Like, that worked really well to me. So there's some hope on that front that Memphis could become a big driver of interest now with Ja Morant and some of these other teams that are still very firmly in the middle, playing huge games right before the beginning of the playoffs, and then, you know, becoming big stories even in a first round series. Like, you know, that Portland LA series had some hype before it ultimately went in the other direction. So that's a positive for the NBA in that sense. We're going to get Caitlin out of here in just a sec. Celtics, Pacers, two games to start this week. I love this when it's happening this year. I thought the league was going to do this on a more full scale basis, these series, mini series in a city, two games, adjustments, almost a little bit like a playoff feel to it in the regular season. I thought that would have been awesome. You get an early playoff matchup type feel for Indiana and Boston if they do eventually match up later. How do you adjust from the first game to the second game? You avoid travel. I don't know how big of a deal that is scientifically to the whole COVID situation, but I thought it would have just been an awesome thing, but they're not doing that on a full scale. We get these occasional series that they're doing it here, but we have this one between Boston and Indiana. For Boston, from my perspective, you've written a lot about these defenses that Indiana's throwing out there. Going to be another massive test for Jason Tatum. Can he read the floor? Can he adjust to double teams? If he picks up that full court, you know, pressing coverage that you've talked about, can he adjust to that? Like, there's a whole lot of things that are going to be thrown from Indiana's side at Jason Tatum that I'm just so intrigued by, because he's the lead creator this year. He's adjusting to that. There's short spurts where Jaylen Brown did it well against Brooklyn, and some of Tatum's limitations in his worst games in that aspect of things kind of limit the Celtics' ceiling. So it's a great pair of matchups here in that regard. And of course, Miles Turner. We can talk quite a ton about how he looks against the Celtics and Tristan Thompson. What are you looking at from the Celtics side against Indiana that's going to test the Pacers?
Well, I think the Tatum thing in general is pretty interesting because, like I said, Warren doesn't look to be 100%. I mean, we'll see how he looks tonight against Chicago, which, I mean, the first game against Boston will be the second night of a back-to-back, which is a whole nother topic because Oladipo has not played in any back-to-backs yet. And when he was asked about that during preseason, he said, well, I don't know if I can play in back-to-backs. I haven't done it. So We'll see if he sits out either one of those. Right now, he's not listed on that he's going to be sitting, but the Tatum thing is interesting because when I was watching them play the Nets yesterday, the Nets were doing quite a bit similar to the Pacers, which seems to be a little bit more of a league-wide trend, and that they were packing it in a lot at the elbows and the blocks quite a bit, which is how the Pacers are setting a lot of their defense. I mean, after a make, they're picking up full court using one full court pest. It's not like an actual full court press, but they're either sending, you know, a TJ McConnell and Aaron Holiday, sometimes even Malcolm Brogdon to pick up. And then when they get back, they're really packing it in and being in an aggressive shift position. So yesterday it seemed like Boston got kind of into catch and hold, and Tatum and Brown both kind of took some fadeaways, some floaters. So with the Pacers, I don't feel like they have a great handle on this yet. The first half against the Knicks did not go well. The Knicks scored 66 points on 55% shooting. So when they weren't forcing a turnover, the defense wasn't great. The second half was the reverse of that. It looks like it by the numbers, because it was like 33 points on 33% shooting after. But that was in part because Julius Randle went to the bench and the Knicks just had no other playmaking. So then we circle back to this. Will the Celtics have enough playmaking, knowing that Kemba Walker is obviously out, to get the ball moving? Because the spot up opportunities on the perimeter are going to be there. Like, if I was a team coaching against the Pacers right now and knowing that they don't have a great handle yet on being on a string and how they're defending so different than they were a year ago, I would be telling them to run flare screens against the nail help and be cutting behind the nail help as much as possible. Like, the more you cut, because they are so exaggerated with how far they're coming over, and then their guards are either too small to close out when they spray back out, or they have a big up there who's just going to be easy to cut right behind. So that's something I'm watching in these early goings for sure, defensively, and just how much they wear out. Like, in the preseason and against the Knicks, you'll see that the Pacers are going to come out at like a breakneck pace in that first quarter. Like, I think they played at about a 118 pace against the Knicks. Wow. By the time they're in the third quarter, they're down over under 100. Like, you can tell that they start getting gassed from doing this. It feels like they're pretty much in default scramble mode, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but they're flying around a lot. So
yeah, in the Celtics, it's not so much that. It's into the rotations. Can you sustain minutes without Tatum? Can you get something from secondary wings? I mean, they are just – Aaron Nesmith hasn't played, so they're searching for stuff from Semi Ojeleye, from Javonte Green, and it's just like, whew, this team is not deep. Maybe they should have done that Indiana trade on certain nights, but they still have that trade exception. Early in the year, I think Boston and Indiana especially are going to be two teams that don't look the same by the end of the year. Like, there's just massive, massive potential for both these teams to make a trade. Probably not with each other at this point. I think those days are over. But somewhere else, like, these teams are not going to look the same as they are today, as they are at the end of the year. And that defense point, like, you know, we're seeing that more and more. Pinches, zones, box and one from Toronto, the drops for these centers, especially seeing DeAndre Jordan do that in Brooklyn. Like, that's just such a joy for him to be able to just drop back and do that. Now, how's that going to work against the three-point offenses that we see in the league today? It has shown the ability to muck up individual games. Toronto definitely did that in the playoffs against Boston. But you're right on top of that. Like, you know, I've been reading a lot of the stuff that Indiana is doing from your perspective and other teams stealing that paint, that it's like, you know, for a team like Boston, they've been thrown off by that big time. Brooklyn did it, as you said, forced Tatum to take a bunch of jumpers, forced, you know, Marcus Smart is going to take those jumpers if the paint is not available there. And that can really throw the, you know, pace flow out of a game. I don't know how I feel about that. They banned the zone for a reason way back when. To try to open up the game and, you know, have some paint availability there against big guys. So I'm going to be watching that all season long. Is that paint restriction going to muck up offense, bring down offense in the league at all this year, make it tougher to teams to try to move the way they want to and all that kind of stuff this year? I think that's a great observation by you.
Yeah, and then also the fact that Boston's kind of boxed in right now to playing Tyson and Thompson together. I mean, that opens up a door for the Pacers that wasn't there last year, because obviously these two teams only played each other twice. But when they played in December, Turner and Sabonis only played 12 minutes together, and they did not play a minute together in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. So that makes them a little bit more playable, though I would say the Turner-Thompson thing, beyond just the dynamics of what happened in the offseason, is interesting because Turner struggled with him. Like, when they played in the 17-18 playoffs, Thompson was out of the rotation. Lou makes the adjustment in that game seven that, hey, you know, we're going to not only just going to increase his minutes, but we're also going to start him. And prior to that, Turner was guarding like a Jeff Green or a Jose Calderon and just sagging off whoever the worst shooter was and being able to kind of camp out and protect the rim that way. And once Tristan was in the lineup, now he's having to defend in space. He's having to guard, and he's improved in that area since over the last 2 years, but the physicality bothered him and he gave up offensive rebounds, and the two of them didn't see each other because only once last year, because they were both out for injuries when the Pacers played the Cavs. But Thompson had a double-double in that game as well and caused problems. So I'll be interested to see if there's a cross match. My assumption would be that Thompson's going to be the one guarding Miles out on the perimeter more than you would be having Tice do that. But on the reverse, I have to think that maybe Bjorkgren, unlike Nate McMillan, was a little inflexible with cross matches, but I'd like to think that Sabonis will be the one more wrestling with Thompson than allowing Miles to kind of get pushed around there. But just the fact that the double big is more playable than it would have been when, you know, Boston had Hayward and Brown and Kemba and Jason. I mean, I don't think the Pacers ever saw all four of them in the same game last year, but it wasn't something that they could rely heavily on in the December matchup.
Yeah, who chases who out of that either? Like, I think it was probably only 12 minutes that those two ultimately, they start the game, but, you know, throughout right. The fall of the game, they kind of broke away from that. I'd love to see that for a full or extended period of a game, especially for Thompson's sake. He's been on a bit of a minutes limit. I'm waiting to see him go full speed here after that hamstring injury he came into camp with, and the potential is there for him to have that kind of, you know, not prove it for his sake, but for the people who wanted Thompson over Turner, this would be a great situation for him to show out and dominate that matchup. But if it goes the other way, I'm gonna have to talk a lot about Turner on our post game show here. Caitlin, great to talk an hour of basketball here with you. If you want to read her work, Indie Cornrows, SB Nation, that's the place to go. She's also on Twitter at C2_Cooper. Caitlin, thanks for being here on Dome Theory.
Hey, thanks for having me on.